to Safe and Sound, New Zealand's only animal rights radio show, broadcasting right across the country. You can download podcasts from our Facebook page, which is Safe and Sound Radio Show and Podcast. I'm your host, Sandra Kyle, and it's my great pleasure to bring you an interview with a very distinguished guest today, Dr. Mark Beckhoff. Mark Beckhoff is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder and is a Fellow of the Animal Behaviour Society and a past Guggenheim Fellow. Mark is an ambassador for Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots program, in which he works with students of all ages, as well as senior citizens and prisoners. And also, Mark is a member of the Ethics Committee of the Jane Goodall Institute. He and Jane co-founded the organization Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Mark is on the board of directors of a number of different organisations working for animals, and he's an honorary member of a fair few more. Mark is the recipient of a number of awards, including the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behaviour Society for major long-term contributions to the field of animal behaviour. He also holds the St. Francis of Assisi Award that was given to him by our very own Auckland SPCA. Mark's a prolific writer. He recently collaborated with Safe and Sound presenter Lindley Tulloch on an article about the treatment of possums in this country. It is hardly possible to believe that he has any spare time at all, but he somehow finds time to ride his bike. I think he used to do competitive bike racing. Lindley recorded this interview with him last week, and so let's listen to it now.
Hi, Mark. It's a real pleasure to have you on our show today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. We're miles and miles away.
I know, it's amazing what technology does, isn't it, bringing us together like this. Look, we're really interested in having a chat with you today about animals and your approach towards them and all the knowledge that you bring to that. We just wanted to start off with, what is wrong with the common thinking that there are higher and lower species?
Basically, the major problem is that it's biologically incorrect. I always like to say animals do what they need to do to be card-carrying members of their species. So there's things that we can do that, you know, rats and possums and stoats and other animals can't do, but there's a lot that they can do that we can't do. So I think it's just mistaken. The main problem also is that when you start using words like lower or higher, lower gets translated into disposable, not as important, less valuable. And higher gets, you know, translated into more valuable, more important, and not disposable. So to me, it's just it's a convenient way to diss other animals and just say, well, we're not getting rid of, you know, valuable animals. We're just getting rid of lower animals. I don't like it at all.
Yeah.
And it's biologically incorrect.
Of course, you come from a scientific background, and so you're able to bring that knowledge base to the table. You know, people often just take this language for granted, don't they? This idea that we can place a value judgment on animals and that we have the right to do that.
That's exactly what happens. We just translate values based on our perceptions of animals, and we think they're simple, and of course research into their, what we call their cognitive and emotional lives, shows how complex and how deep they think. In fact, just when you called, I was writing an essay about how ravens plan for the future and rats know when they have forgotten something, and they'll choose not to do something when they're presented with a task when they know that they just can't do it. So it's easy for people to lower other animals for human interests, but it's really biologically incorrect.
I'm really enjoying your writing, Mark, at the moment. Thank you so much for all the work that you do in that respect. But what I wanted talk about a little bit now was, you've got an approach to conservation which is called compassionate conservation, isn't it? So can you just explain this approach that you use, or conservationist attitude to particular species?
Yeah. Compassionate conservation basically argues that the lives of all individuals matter, and its kind of slogan bumper sticker is first do no harm. So by focusing on individuals, it's removing the concentration that conservationists usually have on species, populations, and ecosystems. You know, hardline conservationists will say, well, you know, we've got a million rats, we've got a million episodes, we've got millions of possums. So it's okay to kill some of them because there's tons of them, and the species will not go extinct. Compassionate conservationists will basically say, no, the life of every individual matters. Just because there's a lot of them, you just can't go kill them. I always jokingly say that I wouldn't want somebody to come up to me and say, we're going to get rid of you because there's lots of you. I say that facetiously, but in fact, that's really how the argument goes. So compassionate conservation is really a way to solve problems and respect the lives of each and every individual.
Yes, it's a very valuable approach, and you and I have been doing some work recently on the issue to do with possums in New Zealand and the disgusting incident where some possums were drowned at a school possum event. I was very happy to have your compassionate conservation approach sort of explained to me. It's not something that I've been particularly familiar with, but I have always agreed with you on that idea that each individual life matters.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what it also does, we have a new book called The Animal's Agenda I wrote with my colleague Jessica Pierce, and we argue that we need to replace the science of animal welfare with the science of animal well-being. And the science of animal well-being likewise concentrates on the lives of each and every individual. And it's really important because, you know, when you start thinking about clearing a country of predators, or you start thinking of getting rid of, quote, invasive pests who don't belong there, there's no way they're going to be killed humanely with compassion and empathy. The sheer numbers just warrant against that. And that's once again where compassionate conservation comes in and says, look, you're dealing with a huge number of animals. There's going to be an amazing amount of pain and suffering. Mm. So therefore, you're just going to have to come up with techniques to better, more humanely control them or manage them. So compassionate conservation is a very compelling way to do conservation without blood, in a sense. It's a way to just do it and not get involved in all the bloody details, if you will.
And I know what you're saying, and I think that some of the ways that this might occur, if there is perceived to be a need to control these animals, might be something along the lines of contraception, managing to make these animals sterile. Is that something that would occur within the paradigm of compassionate conservation?
Right, and I mean, you know, nothing's perfect. And I think to be really fair, there's different views among compassionate conservationists. But nobody doing compassionate conservation, I know, would ever argue that plans that mass killing is using poisons like 1080 or traps or snares is anything humane. And so we could all agree that we should be using humane methods. I suppose there are some compassionate conservationists who would differ with me and say, well, you know, we really need to manage invasive animals and we got to figure out the most humane way to do it. Nobody I know is going to go say, oh, you know, it's okay to just, you know, drop 1080 on them or trap them or drown them.
Yeah.
Or, for that matter, teach kids to kill animals in the most brutal ways.
And in New Zealand, of course, dressing them up in school possum competitions, which is something that, you know, people are becoming more aware of now, and is teaching our children to disrespect and make fun of animals that are deemed pests.
Yeah, that's a great way to develop a culture of killing. And, you know, there's a lot of worry about the relationship between violence to animals and violence to humans. And so when you really cut through the chase, as we say, there's just no way that what is being planned can be done humanely, and there's no way that there won't be what people call collateral damage.
You know, New Zealand's got a real problem, in my view, with having a culture of killing with animals and perceiving animals as dispensable. It's unfortunate.
We came up with that term for exactly that reason, that a lot of what people put forth, I call them feel-good scams. You know, to be fair to people who aren't in the field, to be fair to people who just hear about all the horrific things that, or supposedly horrific things that possums and other animals are responsible for, they really need to know the truth. They need to know the data. They need to know that there is no way to humanely kill all these animals. And they also need to know that training children to do it is a very, very bad road to travel.
just a few years ago, many scientists believed that animals actually didn't have emotions or feelings. Has that changed? And if so, what's changed?
It's changed quite a bit. Once again, there's no scientists I know who would argue that animals don't have feelings, that they don't have emotions. I mean, none whatsoever. They get caught in a bind because, on the one hand, they'll say, we know we're causing pain and suffering, and we know these animals, you know, have emotions ranging from joy and pleasure and happiness to grief and sadness, and, you know, complex emotions like guilt and jealousy and embarrassment. So they got to cover themselves, and the way they often cover themselves is, once again, this humane washing. They'll say, we know they suffer, we know they have these feelings, so we're going to do the best we can. But of course, you know, when they say we want to give these animals a better life is not necessarily a good life. And so things have really changed. I mean, the articles I write, or the stuff I read, just shows so incredibly conclusively how rich and deep the emotional lives of animals are, how much they know, how smart they are. And of course, you know, one of the things that's really important for your listeners and everybody to know is that it's really not a matter of intelligence per se. Really what it comes down to is, can animals suffer? Do they suffer? People go, well, you know, rats and rodents are not as smart as monkeys and chimpanzees and other great apes. But that doesn't matter. I mean, there's no evidence that less intelligent humans suffer less than more intelligent humans. And this is really important because to the people who are doing legislation, the people who are worried about the way in which animals are treated, it really comes down to feelings. Animal welfare, animal well-being is all about feelings. So when I read these essays that, you know, they call them the dumb possums or the dumb stoats or the dumb rats, I'm thinking, well, that doesn't really matter, right? I mean, there's people who are more intelligent than others. Whatever. We just never, ever would treat them differently, or we hope we wouldn't treat them differently, because they supposedly feel less.
Your words are very powerful, Mark, and you've got a very, you know, eloquent way of putting them across, and I think that's a real gift. It made me feel quite emotional just listening to you, because it brings to mind so many animals that I myself have witnessed and watching their behaviour and how it's overlooked so much by people who don't want to see it. Can you give us some examples of the complex emotions that animals display? For example, you've got the famous story about the magpie funeral, and recently I read one about toothpicking of a chimpanzee. Was that you that wrote that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it would be so hard to pick. Like the examples I gave before of ravens planning for the future, rats remembering basically, you know, what they don't know, you know, like students who go into an exam and go, oh, my goodness, I don't remember this. Rats love to play and love to be tickled. Some very detailed neurobiological research showed that they laugh, and that, you know, basically all mammals have the exact same neural architecture underlying their emotions. All mammals have what's called the limbic system, and the limbic system is basically the seat of emotions and feelings. And we know now that many animals grieve the loss of their friends and families, for example. So when you start thinking about the harm that's done to killing these animals, you're not only injuring individuals themselves, but they're suffering the loss of friends and family. Mm-hmm. You know, I always say to people, have you ever lived with two dogs or cats? Mm-hmm. If one disappears or dies, others grieve.
They do grieve. I had a dog that I had to have put down when she had cancer, and my cat, after she was gone, she went back to the spot and she circled the spot over and over again where the dog had been put down, and then she lay down on that spot. And then for about 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, she kept coming and sniffing the same spot and lying down on it, and it was incredible to witness that it really was.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and so, you know, once again, it gets back to your question, you know, about the people who deny that animals have emotions. I always like to say when I give talks, too, that one of the indications that people, scientists, researchers, know that other animals have rich and deep emotional lives is the fact that there's legislation to treat them more humanely.
Right.
I mean, You know, if they didn't feel pain, if they didn't experience pain and suffering and other emotions, then they wouldn't be doing this welfare work. So what they do belies the fact that they know it. And some scientists, like I said, are really good at denying it. They're really good at saying, well, we're doing what we're doing in the name of humans.
Mm, yeah, or we're doing it for the greater good.
It's sort of like these mass killing of animals. And they'll say, well, we're doing it in the name of the animals who these pests kill. But once again, you know, as you know, the science is pretty wishy-washy. I mean, there's no doubt that animals kill one another. It just is a fact of life. But the question comes, of course, are the animals who you're calling pests and who you're blaming really responsible for all the pain and suffering and death for which you're accusing them?
I just want to come back to the magpie funeral because I want to know about the magpie funeral. Are you able to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it was a great story. I ride my bicycle a lot. I used to race bicycles, and I was riding into town with my friend Rod, and we came around a corner, and there was a magpie corpse in the road surrounded by four or five other magpies, and they were standing in a circle. And they were, you know, leaning forward, touching the corpse with their beak. And then one flew off, and another flew off, and they brought back some twigs and some sticks and laid them on and or around the corpse. And I'm sitting there just going, my goodness, I can't believe this. And my friend Rod is astounded as well, and he says to me, this is nothing new for you. You've seen this before. I said, no, I've never seen this before. And while we're watching them, they imperceptibly almost bowed their heads forward and flew off. Oh. I published it, and over the years, I've had numerous emails of the same kind of a funeral ritual, if you will, in magpies. And a woman from Canada sent me a video that is just about exactly what we had seen.
Wow.
And so it's one of my favorite stories, and people have sent, you know, ravens do it, magpies do it. Crows are well known for doing these kinds of rituals. And then people go, well, okay, well, they're the smart birds. You know, what about other birds? And there's also reports of sparrows. And the reason I'm saying this, of course, is sort of tongue-in-cheek, is sparrows are not necessarily dumb. It's just, once again, people think that these birds of prey, like ravens, magpies, and crows, are the smartest birds in the world. And they may be, but once again, it doesn't have any bearing on whether they have the emotions of grief, for example.
A horrible story that came to mind as you were talking. I was just made aware of a mass poisoning of birds recently at a farm that someone came across. She went to pick up some grains and found all these sparrows dying, and she contacted the Ministry for Primary Industries here. And apparently you're allowed to poison birds in New Zealand, just like that. That brings us to the question of morality. I remember using your work in my PhD, and one of the critical points for me about your work was the idea that animals have a morality, and that this morality is actually precursors to human evolution, if I've got that correct. That the morality in animals are evolutionary precursors to human morality.
Yes. Well, basically, there's excellent data now that show that animals have a sense of right and wrong, mammals, likely birds, and we could think of their knowing what's right and wrong, their playing fairly, their behaving fairly, as a precursor to human morality. I mean, it may be, but what that translates into, and it was when you were saying it, it just made me think about the lower and higher animal stuff. You know, people talk about, well, animals show what they call quasi-morality, or proto, meaning sort of primitive morality. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I'm not going to say that non-human animals might have the same sense of right and wrong that we do. They certainly don't sit down and debate it like we do or write books about it. Mm. But once again, what works for them is what works for them. Mm. So I don't like to think of it that way, although it's important when you look at it evolutionarily, to think of where the roots of some of our behavior come from.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, you're going to look at non-human animals. Mm. But there's really good evidence about animals behaving fairly, cooperatively, compassionately, sharing food. My own research is on play behavior and how animals can play with one another, and it only rarely, if ever, develops into true aggression. You know, it's
right.
I study dogs and wolves and coyotes, and you know, people will say, oh, every time my dog goes to the dog park and plays, it develops into a fight. Well, it might for a particular dog, but all the studies have been done that show that really play escalates into fighting about 1 to 2% of the time. So the point that we make when we say animals have morality, they behave fairly, is sure, they fight with one another, and sure, they can harm one another, but it's incredibly rare. The other thing that's important is people come back and say, yeah, well, what about predators killing prey? You know, they're cruel, they're mean. No, they're not cruel and mean. It's their only source of food. They can't go to the store and buy food. And non-human animals don't have, as far as we know, that sense of right and wrong, that a wolf doesn't go, I know it's wrong to kill this elk, but
sorry,
I need it for food. You know, people raise that objection in meetings. Mm. And this ties in, of course, to the mass executions of non-human animals by humans. We do know that it's wrong,
yes,
to harm other animals. Mm. We do know that poisoning them and treating them inhumanely, if you will, is bad for them, and it's wrong. Mm. So we know better. It doesn't mean that we're superior. It just means we know better. I always say non-human animals have bad days just like human animals. You know, we've all done or said things that we wish we didn't do or say. In a book I have coming out about dogs, I write about one of my dogs who just used to get headaches and would really, his personality would change drastically. And, you know, was he really a nasty SOB, if you will? No, he wasn't. But he'd have a bad day just like we could have a bad day. You form these social relationships and, you know, you hope that the bonds are strong enough to generate positive feelings, good feelings. But like I said, animals can have a bad day. Or when I've rescued dogs, you know, I have no idea about their experiences in early life. Mm. And sometimes you find out by, you know, you go to pet a dog in a certain way and they snap at you or they recoil. And, you know, the best thing you can do is stop doing it and just assume maybe these dogs were beaten and they were, you know, they were hit with magazines or hands above their head. It gets back to dogs and other animals having personalities, and some are bold, timid, shy. You just have to appreciate each individual for who they are. And that gets back, of course, to compassion, the conservation, and the science of animal well-being, that individuals matter and individuals really differ. So concerning, you know, the question of whether non-human animals have emotions, Charles Darwin, who's a very famous evolutionary biologist, he actually was a geologist, but he put forth what he called the principle of evolutionary continuity. And what he meant there was that the differences between humans and non-humans are differences in degree rather than differences in kind. And so scientists always like to confuse issues and stuff like that. But what it really means is that the differences are shades of gray, not black and white. And so, you know, if we have joy, quote, they, other animals, have joy. If we have fear, if we have grief or display grief, they do too. And so it's a very simple principle with just a really wide range of application. I like to say we're not inserting something human into non-human animals. So I always come back to Darwin's ideas about evolutionary continuity when I talk to people. You know, a lot of them want the scientific basis for emotions, for example, and that's a really good one. It also gets back to the question, you know, the roots of morality. I say it facetiously, but when you look at what's going on in the world today, when you look at the planned war on predators in New Zealand, when you look at war among human populations, you can question amoral principles. But once again, you could apply Charles Darwin's ideas. It's continuous. They're not, we have it and they, quote, other animals don't.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what you're saying has really important implications for our relationship as humans with other animals. Just to finish off, are you able just to point to some of those implications? For example, would the world be a better place if we were vegan, if we shaped our relationships with animals
Sure.
along those lines?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you can apply principles of evolutionary continuity to a lot of different examples. And of course, when we apply it to the emotional lives of non-human animals that we know they suffer, feel pain, they don't like being harmed, you know, each individual desperately wants to live, if you will, then it comes down to how we treat them. And one of the ways in which we mistreat countless animals is when we serve them up for food. And I know people may disagree, but I'm going to take a fairly strong stance here and just say that it would be nice if the world were vegan. It would be nice if they were the world were vegetarian. It would be nice if everyone in the world tried to cut back their consumption of animals and animal products for meals. And when you sit down and you really think about the pain and suffering that, you know, we call them food animals. I hate that term, but that's what we call them. When you think of the pain and suffering of food animals, then you begin to see how bad the system is, how reprehensible it is when non-human animals are treated, once again, as merely meals. So there's an excellent scientific and evolutionary basis for treating animals better in all venues.
That's a lovely sentence for us to finish up on here, Mark. You know, I think we've learned a lot, and I would like to say that your book, The Animal Agenda, is something that I'm going to be reading and very interested in. Absolutely lovely to talk to you today, Mark. It's a late evening for you over there now?
Oh, no, it's only 5:10 in the afternoon.
Okay, so you've got some daylight left, and you might be able to go and have a nice meal or something. Well,
yes, I'm going to cook myself a lovely vegan pasta meal.
Yay, I wish I could join you. I look forward to meeting you at some stage. Thank you so much for the interview today.
Happy birthday, Lindley.
And we will be
in touch.
Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye now.
Our grateful thanks to Dr. Mark Beckhoff and to Lindley for the interview that you've just heard. I wish it could have been longer, and we're very short of time today, so we won't have a music track. I'd just like to say that we will put the podcast up together with some links on our Safe and Sound radio show and podcast Facebook page. So go and check it out, and go well until you join us again next week. Bye-bye.